for our 10:50 panel. You notice I said 10:50 and it's 11:20. Commissioner Whitmer reminded me you need to learn how to run a meeting on time. And so with that in mind, we're going to kick off our natural gas vehicle policy advocates. It's a pleasure to have with us Dr. Catherine Clay, the Executive Director of Clean America Transportation Alliance. And again, I'd ask everybody to be assembled, cell phones off, in respect to our speaker. So Dr. Clay, we'll just give everybody a moment here, and then the floor is yours.
Thank you.
Great. You may begin.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Commissioners, Chairman, Deputy Secretary. It's a pleasure to be here. And thanks for the opportunity to speak about the role that natural gas can play in transforming our nation's and Pennsylvania's transportation energy future. First, I wanted to say a little bit of introduction about who we are. If I can make sure I'm pointing the clicker in the right direction. Or the next slide, please. So we've recently taken a new name. So I was introduced as the executive director of the Clean American Transportation Alliance. We're now going by the name the Drive Natural Gas Initiative. But it's the same group of companies that we represent. We are a combination of companies that are members of the American Gas Association, so LDCs, and members of America's Natural Gas Alliance, the independent producers of natural gas. We have over 50 participating companies. Together, these important segments of the industry represent a significant portion of the upstream and supply chain for natural gas. And together, we work to support market growth for natural gas vehicles and infrastructure. Chesapeake Energy, Norman Herrera spoke on the first panel very ably, is one of our members. You can see the level of engagement that our members are showing to this issue. Next slide. So first, I just wanted to quickly review the, I was actually frantically revising my presentation during the first panel so as not to be redundant, but I do want to reinforce in certain places some of the key messages the panelists gave in the first part of today's session. One of the main messages, I think, is familiar to everyone in this room, but just to underscore these important points, the reason that we're talking about natural gas as a transportation fuel is because of the tremendous public benefits that it potentially can provide. First, NGVs are clean. They produce 60 to 90% lower emissions of criteria pollutants, so important to communities striving to get back into air quality attainment. It's affordable. Natural gas prices are projected to remain low and stable compared to gasoline and diesel, which of course benefits consumers and the budgets for cities and school districts that choose to move to natural gas transportation. And it's job creating, supporting local economies, and also on a national scale, helping to improve the balance of trade for our nation as we displace foreign oil imports with domestic natural gas. Next slide. As a context globally for our national discussion, it's very important to remember that this is something that is actually a global phenomenon that we're grappling with. Ironically, while our nation is today the world's largest producer of natural gas, we only have about 1% of the world's natural gas vehicles on U.S. roadways. So of about 12, almost 13 million natural gas vehicles worldwide, only about 120,000 of those are here in the United States. Other nations are recognizing the benefits of natural gas. Notable markets are Europe, South America, Asia, and the Middle East. We have a lot that we can learn from the positive experiences of these other countries. You've seen a similar version of the slide a couple of times before, but it is so important that I think it bears repeating. And if you click just one more time, the bottom line here is that this decoupling means that there is a significant price advantage for natural gas at the pump on an energy equivalent basis. So on an apples-to-apples comparison, a gasoline gallon equivalent basis, CNG available at retail stations across the country today, that national average is about 50% lower than the cost of gasoline or diesel. And that decoupling started with, of course, the shale gas revolution. We saw that significant decoupling. That's what's changed the energy landscape of the country so dramatically. And I think that, reflecting a little bit on some of the discussion from the first panel, that as you consider some of the historical examples given by some of the first panelists, in particular the experiences of some of the utilities in the 1990s. Let's remember that the primary context has changed. If we were to list, if there had been private industry involved in this market in the 1990s and they had failed, and we were to put up a list of there, I don't think it would be a fair conclusion to say that it's because it was in an inappropriate market. In just the same way, listing failures or utilities that exited this market in the 1990s, it is really not a relevant argument because we have such a different energy context and such a different market context today. And then just to bring that home, I brought this slide to show you just the kind of we see the same general picture across the country, but there is variability, of course, city to city. But overall, the general message is the same, that on a gasoline gallon equivalent basis, CNG provides a significant price advantage, and that's really what we're seeing drive a lot of the interest in the market pull. The fleets, and I'll go quickly through these next couple of slides because they also underscore some of the messages you've heard before, but we are now in a period where we're seeing on almost weekly basis that there are national fleets, companies are turning to natural gas vehicles for their fleets, and remember this is in a market without subsidies, either for the federal subsidies, either for the infrastructure or for the fleets, and it's because it's making sense for the markets. And so the major companies, Waste Management, of course, as mentioned earlier, made a very exciting announcement just a couple of weeks ago. UPS, AT&T, Comcast, others, I won't read the whole slide, but also, as was mentioned, trash, transit, and fleets are clearly the early wins in this market. If we go to the next slide, we're also encouraged because we're seeing OEMs re-entering the market in the light-duty segment. Now, of course, if you remember the global context slide I showed just a few moments ago, these same light-duty manufacturers are very engaged in overseas market. In Europe today, for a retail consumer, there are 22 models available for retail consumers to purchase natural gas-powered vehicles. In the United States today, there's only one, the Honda Civic natural gas. But we have these two exciting new entrants that were announced this year by GM and Chrysler. Now, these are initially, of course, going to be marketed towards fleets, but we see that's the way that the market progresses. You know, the OEMs get the base of their customers in the fleet market, get that experience, start getting their retail apparatus and their distribution networks in place. That's exactly how the Honda Civic transitioned from a fleet vehicle to now a retail marketed vehicle. And we hope that the same pattern holds true for these OEMs. But what will it take to reach the tipping point? We've seen these entrants, these leaders in the markets, in the fleet managers, the OEMs among heavy, medium, and light-duty fleet and vehicle and engine manufacturers. But we really need to work to provide a virtuous cycle. We've talked too long about the chicken and egg problem. We need to be talking about moving in lockstep with our partners. We see ourselves as the infrastructure part of the equation, but success is a combination of infrastructure and vehicles and consumer acceptance. So what does it take to reach that? Well, there is the part that we bring to the table. The role of utilities is first, we're part of that infrastructure solution. We have a role to play in helping grow that national fueling infrastructure, and also, importantly, providing early demand through making commitments to our own fleets. Our members on the LDC and on the producer side have made major commitments to converting our own fleets to natural gas and are continuing those commitments. I also want to acknowledge the importance of early demand through state leadership. This was mentioned earlier about the memorandum of understanding among the 14 governors. This is a critical program. The ability to aggregate demand across state fleets to make it a sustainable early demand market that catches the attention of the Detroit manufacturers and others, this in combination with the kind of commitments that you're seeing by the natural gas companies, I think in aggregate is really going to provide part of that momentum towards that tipping point. So the main messages that I want to leave you with, because of course this the focus of our discussion today is really at its core, what is the role of the utility and how can regulators work to make it work for the consumer, the ratepayer, and still capture the public benefits that natural gas vehicles can provide. So the first point is this is an enormous challenge. This is we're talking about building out a statewide in Pennsylvania and ultimately to make that powerful a national refueling infrastructure. We are going to need many business models and many players making investments if we are to be successful. So one of the main messages I'd like to leave you with is to suggest that there is not a one-size-fits-all solution for any state or for any market segment. And it isn't a black and white choice. So the choice that lays before you as commissioners is not one, I would suggest, of whether to allow utilities to participate in the refueling infrastructure. It's just a matter of what's the right way. And there are other jurisdictions that are doing very innovative things as they grapple with this question, because certainly LDCs are going to be involved in this refueling infrastructure. The distribution pipelines that will feed these retail stations, even if those are completely built on a competitive non-rate-based model by companies such as Clean Energy or others. LDCs are in that mix because they're providing that distribution. Some of the other jurisdictions around the country are asking the question, where should the handshake take place? Even if the decision is taken not to have LDCs participate as retailers of the gas, it's possible to think creatively about how much of that infrastructure before the dispenser pump is appropriate to be part of the rate base or part of the responsibility of the LDC. For example, in Georgia, a recent decision last fall allows Atlanta Gas and Light to use what's called their Universal Service Fund. It's a fund that traditionally has been set aside for them to expand their mains for new housing developments and the like. With the recession, they found that they had a surplus of funds. They proposed to their regulators that they use the surplus because of the public benefits that it could provide to help invest in retailers, to partner with retailers of natural gas refueling stations. So the LDC will not have its logo on that station. The LDC does not own and operate that dispenser pump, but is involved in the investment in the compressors, the dryers, the other parts of that configuration up to the point of the dispenser. Another very interesting case that is still under review is in California. Southern California Gas is seeking approval for a very similar kind of provision in kind that seeks approval to provide natural gas compression services. These natural gas compression services, offering gas at pressure, a core function of a utility, would be certainly available to retail providers of natural gas refueling, but to any other customer that had a need for high-pressure gas. So that's another example of something under consideration. But I think the main takeaway is it's not all or nothing. There are many creative ways to think about it. We have to look at the local circumstances and what we need to do to seed the market. And then I just wanted to close by drawing your attention to some work that's going on under auspices of NARUC. This is under the leadership of Commissioner Isiagu of Michigan. He's convened an alternative fuel ad hoc working group, and the work is exploring whether we could have a resolution brought before NARUC in the summer, at the summer meeting, talking about basic principles for how regulators can approach these kind of decisions. Some emerging principles, and I want to be sure to be clear that this is these are only emerging. This is still in the process of a development. But the emerging principles that have been identified are, first, that we should seek ways to facilitate LDC participation in building out alternative fuel vehicle infrastructure, both for electrics and for natural gas, and that we should look at local market conditions. Certainly some markets are going to be more ready for a fully competitive market. Others are not going to be ready in the near term. The long-term goal, as a second principle, should be a competitive market. But a rate-based approach may be essential as a transition to many regions, or even in regions where there is a good groundwork for competition, there may be localities that are left out, and it may be appropriate to have the LDC have a role in filling in those gaps. So keeping the door open rather than a blanket kind of statement, showing flexibility is a wise way forward. And then finally, to provide parity between all alternative fuel vehicle options. So as we make regulations that affect electric vehicles and electric utilities participation in that market, as we do the same on the natural gas side, that we should seek to have dialogue between those two sides of the regulators and the regulated community, and make sure that we have commonality and parity as much as possible. And with that, I thank you for your attention and look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, Dr. Clay. Our next presenter is Richard Collage, president of NGV American. Sir, I apologize if I was not pronouncing your last name right.
You know, you're the first one to mispronounce my name. I'm used to it. Thank you for having me as the speaker today. We were sent a list of 10 questions, and you've heard a lot of the introductory stuff, a lot of overviews, so I figured I'd answer the 10 questions. First question, beyond the incremental cost, what is the primary obstacle or obstacles to the success of the natural gas vehicle market? Surprise, fueling station infrastructure, information, and the number of vehicle models. We have about 1,100 fueling stations. And now we're growing. We're growing very rapidly. We're adding right now about 15 or 20 stations, a week or, a month, actually 20 stations a month. And that's great. And that's going to increase. But there's 150,000 gasoline stations out there. There's 75,000 diesel stations out there. We can't be all things to all people right away. In some communities, like Los Angeles, the four counties around Los Angeles, there's 100 public stations. In Salt Lake City, there's a network of fueling stations. We're seeing consumers now very attracted to that market. As a matter of fact, for a long time, every used natural gas vehicle that went on the market found its way to Salt Lake City. It was like a funnel. All those vehicles came down because there was an infrastructure there. And over time, we're going to see those hubs growing. But right now, we don't have that. So as you heard earlier, we're focusing on the fleets. We're focusing initially on return-to-home fleets, fleets that go out, do their job, come back to a common depot. You can serve that fleet. One station in a big public or big private sector fleet can serve that entire fleet. One station in an industrial park can serve 10 or 15 smaller fleets. There are also point-to-point vehicles. There are tens of thousands of vehicles, big vehicles in the United States, that do nothing but go between one city and another. New York, Washington, New York, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, Pittsburgh and Chicago. That's all they do, they go back and forth. What are point-to-point vehicles? Point-to-point vehicles or return-to-home vehicles are two homes. So station either end, you serve those fleets. Even in the big markets, the big truck markets, people think that when you think of a trucker, you think of Burt Reynolds, driving between Atlanta and Memphis today, and then Chicago, then to Dallas. And independents do that, but big truck fleets don't do that anymore. They have depots all across the country. A trailer goes across the country. The tractor picks up a vehicle, let's say San Diego, drives to Reno, drops off that trailer, picks up one going west, and goes home. The tractor goes back and forth. It's a point-to-point vehicle, which is a return-to-home vehicle with 2 points. So those are the stations we've been going after, and very successful. And we can talk about that. We already heard some discussion about it. The second thing is information, especially for consumers. If we're going to grow this market in the consumer market, someone has to inform the consumers. The big fleets know about natural gas vehicles. The consumers and the smaller fleets need more customer information. So that's an important role, especially for utilities to play. Utilities are one of the most trusted entities in the community. And people will go to the utility, ask for information. The utilities have to be in a position to to answer those questions, to be knowledgeable about what's available, how much does it cost, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, in a number of models. In some markets, transit, every transit bus manufacturer now makes natural gas vehicles. Every trash truck manufacturer makes natural gas vehicles. Every street sweeper makes natural gas vehicles. But when you get down to the light-duty market, as Catherine said, we've got the Honda Civic GX. Over time, that's going to change. I think we're seeing a lot of interest by the OEMs. But right now, we got one. We need more models in those applications. Second question, what will the impact for further development be on demand for natural gas and the long-term price of natural gas? Minimal. According to EIA, the Energy Information Administration, we used about 23 trillion cubic feet of gas. If we serve 25 million light-duty vehicles, that would increase the demand for natural gas less than 7%. If we use 25, if we get 25% of all the heavy-duty trucks and buses, that would increase the demand for natural gas less than 6%. Put that in perspective. DOE has approved, now they haven't been built, but DOE has approved export terminals that would increase the demand for natural gas 19%. And there's been export applications in that would increase the natural gas demand by 27%. Now, we have a choice here. What do we do? Do we export the gas or we use it here? I think we talked about that a little bit earlier. So that's on the demand side. On the price side, the price of natural gas right now, it's great for the consumer, but it's too low to maintain the supply growth that we were seeing. The price is going to have to come up, and it's going to come up, no matter what happens, it's going to go up. If we do nothing, it's going to go up because producers are going to be leaving the market. They're going to be producing oil. They're going to be doing something else with their money. So the supply will come down, demand will stay, increase, the price is going to go up. If you start exporting some, the price is going to go up because of the increase in demand. If you use more for all applications, like natural gas vehicles, it's going to increase the price. Whatever is going to happen, it's going to increase the price at some point. I don't know what that is, whether it's $3.50 or $4, but it's increased the price. But there's so much gas out there that natural gas is going to be available for natural gas vehicles, no matter what price level. And by the way, as Norman pointed out before, at the current price, let's say $2, in the field, the price of natural gas is only 25 cents a gallon. Even if you double the price to $4, it's only 50 cents a gallon. We're going to be competitive. Next question, how will increased demand resulting from NGVs affect the utility infrastructure? I don't see that happening very much. Obviously, it's going to change for the individual utilities. As everyone said, we're not going to be accessing all this market all at once. The LNG stuff, which is the fastest growing stuff right now, that's outside the utility business. So we're only talking about CNG, and that's going to grow, but grow slowly. Plus, much of the fueling is going to be done off peak, so you're not going to be adding. Even whether it's home refueling or whether it's time filling at a private firm, it's going to be happening off peak. So you're not going to be adding that much to the demand. And also, most of the early stations are going to be in urban areas where you already have an infrastructure. So it's not like we're going to have to add a whole lot of pipe just to serve that market. And as has been pointed out already, the increased natural gas vehicle use is going to increase the efficiency of the utility system. So I just don't see that much impact on the utility infrastructure. To what extent will utility investment in the infrastructure be necessary to address demand for NGVs? Here's an equivocal response. It all depends. If we're talking about distribution infrastructure, obviously we just answered that. I don't think much. If the utility is getting involved in the fueling station infrastructure, we're talking about a significant amount of investment. I think Norman showed that chart of all that convenience stores that are now talking about this. In the last 6 months, I bet we've talked to most of the major convenience stores in the United States. They're all interested in putting infrastructure. This is going to happen. The question is, where is it going to happen and how fast? In a number of states, the legislatures have been providing incentives to put in stations, whether it's to the municipalities or whether it's to private firms. You can talk about that. If the PUCs want to incentivize station development, you have a lot of options. I think you're probably familiar with the NRRI study. It's called Natural Gas Vehicles, What State Public Utility Commissioners Should Know and Ask. It's really a very well-done report, a very well-done briefing paper, very balanced, and it doesn't make any recommendations. Just say, here's all your options. And if you haven't looked at it, I would recommend it. What lessons have we learned? Oh, boy, we have so many lessons. One, nobody is born knowing about the advantages of natural gas vehicles. So you just can't put in a fueling station. You can't do the if we build it, they will come. There's got to be customer education. There has to be customer outreach, and that's critical. That is so critical to getting this market growing. You have to be, and you have to be talking to prospective customers, not after you build a station, before you build a station. You got to be out there laying the groundwork for the station development. Another one, you have to have enough fueling capacity. The cost of fueling stations are somewhere between $7,000 for a home refueler installed and $4 million for a huge three-gas compressor station for, let's say, transit buses. And there's everything in between. If you don't have enough capacity, if you try to do it on the cheap, and people come in and they start waiting 10 or 15 minutes, they expect when they walk in there, they're going to go drive in there, they're going to get gas at the same rate, same speed as with gasoline. If you have a station that can't do that, you're setting yourself up, everybody is setting themselves for trouble. Another lesson, we already talked about individual consumers are nice. Fleets are essential if you're going to have profitable stations, and you have to have profitable stations, especially early on. Another lesson, when stations are few, people are dependent on that station. That station can't go down. And if it goes down, you have to have it up right away. There has to be telemetry equipment. Todd talked about that a little bit. There has to be telemetry equipment so you know immediately when a station's down, and you can get a crew out there to get that station up within an hour. Because, again, when stations are few, if you've got a dedicated vehicle, no station, no fuel. Next question, what lessons have been learned? Oh, yeah, lots. I forgot that. Yeah, we learned lots of lessons. What kinds of recovery tariffs are appropriate to support the market? I've lost my place. If the PUCs, you know, it really depends on the term appropriate. If the PUCs want to encourage this, there are a number of options. Todd laid out a whole list of things, very good list. Let me expand on just one right at the end. The California PUC wanted to encourage the Southern California Gas Company to increase the use of natural gas vehicles. So they set up a program where there was actually money flowing to the shareholder if the program was successful. Each year, they set a stretch target in terms of natural gas going to vehicles. And if they exceeded that by certain percentages, certain amount of money would go right to the shareholder. That is a very exciting program for utility management because it really helps the shareholder. And you only get the money if you're successful. And if you're not going after it, it's fine. You're not being mandated to do it, but if you want to go after it, you can bring money to the shareholder. And it was a very successful program. In fact, it's so successful that Southern California has more natural gas fueling stations than any place in the country. Will there be sufficient competition? All right. Eventually, yes. You got two kinds of competition. You have natural gas on natural gas competition, and that's growing. As I mentioned, Los Angeles, it's there. in Utah, it's there, a number of other places, and it's growing. Once you get that infrastructure in, they're going to compete. But the real competition is not natural gas to natural gas. It's natural gas and gasoline, natural gas and diesel. And there are, as I said, 150,000 fueling stations out there. And those people are very competitive. Natural gas has to be much less expensive if we're going to convince these fleet people and others to go to natural gas vehicles. And so that is going to act as the competitor and will continue to act as the competitor for decades to come. How do you create a level playing field for utilities, retail natural gas suppliers, and fueling stations? Well, smart and thoughtful regulation. Put that down. It's really not, the question is level playing field. It should be level playing. It should be a fair playing field. You know, big companies have an advantage. Big, stable companies have an advantage, like utilities. You can borrow money if you're a utility, because you're a utility, you're big and stable, less money. That's fair. That's a natural advantage. What shouldn't be put in place, as we've already been talked about, is any kind of regulatory imposed advantage. A fair playing field through smart and thoughtful regulation, and we're gonna see this market grow. The fueling stations are gonna be there. It's gonna be fair. Nine, who should undertake the retail sale of NGV fuels, the utility or non-regulated utilities? Let 1,000 flowers bloom. I mean, we want everybody out there. Again, fair competition. But we want everyone out there. This question was a little different to others. It also said, who should undertake customer education? Same answer, everybody. But a utility especially has a role because they're so trusted in the community. And finally, this one, how could regulatory lag keep utilities from adjusting to swings in market prices and make them less competitive? Again, smart and thoughtful regulation. Not my area. I don't think there is would be a market lag in this area. The cost of gas would adjust automatically. The rest are fixed costs that don't change very much. So, I leave that smart and thoughtful regulation. So that's the answer to the 10 questions that were sent.
Great. Our last presenter here for this panel will be Dennis Smith, director of the Clean Cities Program for the U.S. Department of Energy, and I'm proud to report Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission has been very active in promoting the Green Button Initiative, and a number of our utilities, including PECO and PPL, have joined in that effort. So a little self-promotion, but it's a good segue
that's great.
Into your presentation.
Been good partners. Now, I do have one problem with one of Rich's comments. Truckers make you think of Burt Reynolds?
Not me personally.
Okay. Thank you for having me today. Really, all the previous speakers, if you haven't picked up on one thing, it's that there's plenty of work to do to keep all of these entities, all these organizations busy performing different roles. And I know at the onset of this forum, you mentioned that one of the things you hope to do is identify what's the appropriate role for utility companies. Well, really, I'd say it's trying to identify what's the appropriate role for utilities, for the regulated as well as the unregulated municipal utilities, for the utility commission, for government entities, for these private sector fuel providers. That's sort of the challenge, is how to identify what's the piece of the puzzle you need to work on and how to coordinate and collaborate with each other. So I really think that that is a key to it. And I think hopefully some of my comments will point us in the right direction of how to help with those collaborations. And I think most of the questions that are the first to come to people's mind on this market is, even though they're can be very complex, they usually fall into categories of, where am I going to get these vehicles? Where am I going to get the refueling? And how am I going to pay for it? Kind of everything falls into those, and maybe how do I get people to drive the vehicles too, but that sort of gets answered with the others. Well, I really feel like those are key things that most all the previous panelists are going to be working on, but I'm also trying to, for purposes of this forum, help identify some things that maybe people aren't always thinking of, this coordination and this collaboration on some of the smaller things. The program that I manage at the Department of Energy in Washington, D.C., is now almost 20 years old. It's called the Clean Cities Program, and our sole mission is to really develop partnerships and to support local decisions and in communities around the country to help make this transformation to alternative fuels so that we can hopefully get off of this addiction to oil and petroleum. And we really want to accelerate the widespread adoption of these things. And the only way that's going to happen is to really for us to leverage the people and resources, because no one organization, no one state is going to be able to do this on their own if we're not working together and trying to do things consistently and to the greatest extent possible. Our program, yes, we've had some funding to throw at those things of how you're going to get the vehicles, how you're going to pay for them, how you're going to get the refueling. And then we had $300 million under the Recovery Act, and that money is going to work right now. Under those recent awards, it's helping to deploy over 1,500 new alternative fueling stations and charging stations, as well as 8,500 alternative fuel and electric vehicles. And by the way, most of my comments today, even though I'm on the natural gas panel, are for electric, for natural gas as well. The way we've really approached trying to coordinate these projects is really by working with local coalitions around the country. And this map that you're looking at now is we've got nearly 100 of these clean cities coalitions, we call them, that serve about 78% of the population of the country. And in each of those areas where you see a dot, we've designated that local coalition where they've got fuel providers, they've got local government people who want to work on these things together. They've got the right combination of people who know how to get things done in their community to really work on these problems. And guess what? They know how to work with each other. So if you're in Pennsylvania and need to find out what were they doing in Utah, they can call the other dot on the map and find out how to make that work. So that's the key to making, I think, most of our programs work, is this coordination and this collaboration. And I really suggest to you that that's really where some things need to take place. And in fact, we've got two coordinators, two coalitions in Pennsylvania right now, and those coordinators in the audience, I'll introduce them before we're over here. Next slide, please. Let's take a minute to talk about, I know when I was invited to this, so one of the early remarks somebody told me over the phone is, well, Pennsylvania's been deregulated, so a clear path to getting alternative fuels. Well, really, I guess my point here is, so your state is deregulated and ready to roll. Well, we've heard that in other areas, but quite honestly, that usually means that some of the regulations dealing with the fixed pricing controls, who can buy and sell the commodity, those things have been deregulated. But often there's still a lot of obstacles, red tape, confusion, and outdated or inadequate policies that still need to be addressed, not all under the purview of the Public Utility Commission, but still the devil is really in the details of these behind-the-scenes things. And let me give you some examples that may seem silly and simplistic, but they can be a brick wall just as sure as not having a fueling station there can be. And one is, what's a gallon of electricity or natural gas? I mean, most people understand what a gallon of gasoline is, but you'd be surprised, it's still different. This is usually it's up to the state. Sometimes the weights and measures. Sometimes it's the Department of Agriculture that determines what's a gallon of each of those commodities. So that can be very confusing. And I can't tell you how many fueling stations we've got for right in Washington, D.C. They're giving away hydrogen for free because they haven't figured out what's a gallon of it to figure out how to tax it, how to measure it, how to dispense it. So just give it away for free. I don't know how that business model is going to work for very long. But still, simplistic, somebody in the state, and some of these examples I'm going to give you may not be your purview, but as commissioners, I think it would be helpful if you can reach across the aisle to other state agencies and say, hey, have we answered these questions in our state? What's being done? And is it being consistent with what's going on in neighboring states? And as I just mentioned, how are you going to measure and how are you going to tax it? Compressed natural gas is a gas. It's like helium in a balloon. So are you going to sell it per balloonful or by BTU? What are you going to do? And then similarly, some challenges with electricity. Again, in some places, they haven't figured out how to sell the electricity, so they're packaging it creatively as a service and not by kilowatt hours or whatever, got to be addressed. This has to be addressed because not only is it important to be done a certain way and consistently just so it makes sense, but for the poor driver who might have a delivery vehicle that's going across a county line and it's another jurisdiction, how's it going to work for them? Do you have an official point person or lead department that coordinates your initiatives in your state or your region? I can't tell you how many times I get questions that come to me at the Department of Energy, and they're telling me, well, I'm glad I finally got somebody who can talk about alt fuels. That, you know, I've been transferred from the Department of Transportation to the Department of Agriculture to the Department of Commerce. Nobody seems to be a point person on this. So first thing is I tell them, well, you want the Department of Agriculture. But then I try to say, well, we really, you know, you need to coordinate on these things, and let's figure out what the questions are, what the barrier is, and figure out who the right person is. So I can't overemphasize the importance of just that one thing. Have a point person on your staff that's the person that these questions go to, and they know who to coordinate with. Sometimes states have these outdated sale for resale restrictions on natural gas and electricity. When the utility commissions were first set up years ago, fueling vehicles with these commodities was not an inkling in anybody's mind. And so many of the rules are still on the books that prevent anybody from, except an established utility, to actually sell these commodities. And sometimes even when you get that out of the way, then there's a rule that says nobody but one of the utilities can have the equipment to dispense the fuel and have the pipe that's connected to it or whatever. So who can sell it as well as dispense it? Make sure those questions are appropriate to provide the convenience stores and whoever needs to be able to engage in that business without having to go through becoming a utility themselves. And I mentioned this earlier, this inconsistency across maybe neighboring utility service territories. The Utility Commission regulates the large public utilities, but it may very well be also you've got these non-regulated municipal or city-owned utilities. We need to make sure that they're doing things consistently and in a way that makes sense. So need to engage in collaboration so that, again, these fleet drivers don't just happen to cross the county line and, boy, then it's a different world. Pricing's completely different. You know, a gallon is completely different. Let's coordinate among these, and whether it's the municipals, co-ops with electricity or whatever. Very important that you at least get to the table together and discuss those things. And then finally, a lot of talk today about safety and so forth. Are your state fire marshals and your public safety officials trained and ready for this? Or are they scared to death of it and they don't know what it is? Have they really been properly prepared? They can be your best ally or your worst impediment. You can't get a permit for that station or they won't allow it to open even after you've gone through all the trouble to figure out how to finance it and get it installed. Key part of the team that needs to play together there. Next slide, please. So I know all these things take time and resources, and so one of the things I want to tell you about today is a funding opportunity, a grant that we've got on the street right now. Due date for the applications is just a little more than 2 weeks away, where we want to help to coordinate some of these things, these impediments. The title of it is Implementation Initiatives to Advance Alternative Fuel Markets. Now, this is just $5 million, which may not seem like a lot, but we're not talking about building the stations here. We're talking about trying to solve all of this confusion, trying to help you coordinate with these other entities to make sure these confusing questions are answered, that you've got policies in place that make sense, that aren't going to be an impediment at the end of the line. So we're really seeking projects to remedy these obstacles and to really facilitate good policy development, training, market development, barrier reductions, and things along those lines. So we estimate we'll be making between 10 to 15 awards, ranging from $250,000 to $500,000, for you to put these teams together to help solve these situations, to come up with things that make sense not only in Pennsylvania, perhaps, but maybe partner with neighboring states or in other areas to really get these questions answered, to really come up with a plan that makes sense for your community. We did something similar for electric vehicles last year, and some of those projects are well underway. All the alternative fuels are eligible under this. We want to get all these questions answered. We truly believe that it is an all-of-the-above approach. It's not a matter of finding the one fuel or the one kind of vehicle that makes sense for everybody. Face it, these don't make sense for everybody. But for the ones that do make sense, they make very good sense, and we need to focus on matching those niches and those applications with where the things line up. So for additional information, that's the website to get to put the applications together. The next slide, I would say the next steps is to really, regardless of whether we've got funding to help with this or not at the Department of Energy from year to year, the key to it is to form these successful collaborations and partnerships, particularly with people who have been through this elsewhere and been successful in other areas. And that's the key to part of this network of these nearly 100 Clean Cities coalitions, is we can find people elsewhere in the country who have done this before, who have been through it with innovative utility regulation, who can give you some tips or some things that you may want to copy, whether it's the taxation of the fuel and how that works, or how regulatory treatment was in place there. So today in the room, we've got your two Pennsylvania Clean City coordinators, Tony Bandiero, which works in the eastern part of the state, and Rick Price. Raise your hands. I think they're both here. So you can talk with them about partnerships at any time, but in particular, they've probably already read the funding opportunity announcement several times. You can talk to them about that. And we really had you in mind when we wrote that, because when we talked, we said teaming arrangements are so critical. And I just want to read a sentence or two out of that funding opportunity. We said team members of particular interest to the DOE include state agencies like state energy offices and local government agencies and organizations, transits, utilities and utility regulators, fuel providers, fuel retailers, truck and bus dealerships, public or private fleets, vehicle and equipment manufacturers, energy marketers, energy companies, standards development organizations, universities, labor and trade units, and training organizations. Did I miss anybody? Yeah, I think that should be everybody in the room ought to be partnering together to help solve these things.
Got notary publics.
Them too. So we're saying there's a role in this for everyone, and really to be successful, everyone needs to be engaged with it. So thank you for your time.
Dennis, thank you, and I was impressed with your comment. It really is an all-the-above strategy, and the fact that you guys recognize that at the Department of Energy, and appreciate your participation here. I want to apologize to the panelists because of our time constraints. We have to jump into the next panel, but what I will promise you is offline, we'll be around all day. My colleagues and I can have an opportunity to chat with you, or we can email you some questions. It is by no means to take away from your presentations, which I think we all agree were very well done. And again, thank you for being here this morning.